This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Has the FA Cup lost its? Oh no, it hasn't. A brilliant set of quarterfinals and the plucky underdogs Coventry City and Manchester United make it through to face each other in the semis. At Old Trafford, United never gave up. Liverpool thought they'd won it twice, but Antony kicked it with his right foot for the first time to take it to extra time. Then Amad Diallo won it in injury time in extra time. And so the man who saved Sir Alex could end it for Ten Hag. Mark Robbins yelling at ball boys as Coventry scored twice in injury time to win at Wolves. Chelsea beat Leicester despite scoring one of the all-time great own goals. They'll play Man City, who won predictably comfortably against Newcastle. In the Premier League race for the top four, Spurs winning at life but losing at Fulham, while Aston Villa need a late equaliser and a lot of VAR to get a point at West Ham. At the bottom, Luton finally score one late as opposed to letting one in. And is there hope for Burnley? No, not really, but they do win a game. There's a great Champions League draw and an England squad to digest. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, welcome.
Hello, mate. You well?
I am good. Hello, Paul McInnes.
Good morning, Max.
And hello, Robin Cowan.
Hi, Max.
Let's start at Old Trafford then. Manchester United 4, Liverpool 3 after extra time. Just a brilliant game, Robin. You know, the lead changing hands three times. Liverpool thinking they've won it. Antony, then that Rashford miss. And then that break in injury time. Oh, and how slowly the winner went in. I mean, it was just so good, wasn't it?
Oh, superb. And actually, when I thought Manchester United were really good in the first half, but then they go in at the break 2-1 down. And you think from there, that's probably them done. But fair play to them. They were pretty brave against Liverpool team, who I think, yeah, maybe are a little bit tired. I think, you know, I guess it's a bit like Villa and West Ham, we'll get onto later. But they all had that Thursday night trip. I mean, obviously, Liverpool's was an absolute stroll in the Europa League. No, absolutely fantastic. And yeah, I mean, listening to the pod on Thursday, you asked John Bruin whether he gave Manchester United any chance. And I think he's now eating his word.
He is.
Isn't he?
Yes, yeah. Very good. He is. We didn't really have time for much, so he just said no. And quite a moment, Paul, for Amad Diallo. I mean, getting the red card that sort of quite a few, I think a lot in the crowd didn't even know he'd been sent off because they were just too busy celebrating. The BBC Radio Manchester commentator Gaz Drinkwater completely exploded. And it was absolutely brilliant. But for a guy who's not really done much, is that his first goal for United? I think it is. I mean, what? Arguably no better way to score your first goal for Manchester United.
No, I think he's a player who is, I don't think I'm wrong here, has a sort of mystique around him for United fans because he has never really been given a chance in the first team, signed as a prodigy from Udinese, I think, and has been kind of in and around the squad, but only really made an impression on loan last year at Sunderland. So I think fans are interested to see him. He was clearly kind of keen to make his mark on the game as well. And I think, you know, to be able to find that, I think some people said Kelleher could maybe have done better with the save, but it was so precise. I think you've really got to get a lot of credit to Amad, and yeah, a great finish, great way to win the game. And you know, I don't think it's unlikely he will be would be expected to feature in the next couple of games, so he can probably take on the ban.
Yeah,
as well.
And Robin alluded to it, Jordan. You know, it's massive for Ten Hag, and he did go for it. You know, he had what Maguire and Diallo as the only recognised defenders on the pitch at the end. Antony's left back, Bruno's sort of playing at the back.
Yeah, and I'm a bit conflicted in how I analyse Ten Hag during this match, because I'm the first one to put the knife in when he gets his tactics and his substitutions wrong when they lose. So you've got to be fair and say that, you know, when they win, you've got to give him credit. But I'm not convinced this game was about tactics and subs. I think the beauty of this game was that it wasn't really about tactics. It was about just who wanted it more. And I think United constantly coming back when they seemed like they were dead, I thought was something that a lot of my United fan friends said for the first time in a long time, we saw our players actually, you know, wanting it, desire, heart, all those cliche words. But it came down to, we will not let Liverpool win this quadruple on our watch, on our stadium. It's not happening. We can be shite the whole season, but this is the one game where we're not going to sit down and die. And again, I've been very critical of Man United players, but some of the players, you know, Antony, I don't think was brilliant, but he got a big goal. Rashford missed a shocker, but he then redeemed himself to a degree with another goal. Great touch, by the way. So as someone that, I'm a fair man, Max. I've been putting the boot on United all season, but to be fair to them, it was a good moment for them. And just briefly on Ten Hag as well, Ineos, in terms of the ownership or part owners, he's clearly on trial, Ten Hag, right? And I think they're looking for a reason to not fire him. And I just wonder if games like yesterday, where tactically I don't think he showed anything amazing, but if he can show that, look, I've still got these guys playing for me, that may carry a lot of favour in terms of whether they think, okay, we will give you 200, 300 million more in the summer with a better infrastructure around you.
I don't know. I think it might be heritage. You know, they're very into heritage, aren't they? Knocking other teams off their perch. And I think it would be very apt to fire him after they've won the FA Cup, like they did with Louis van Gaal. I think that, you know, heritage.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. I do think actually, in a way, what Jordan says there, Paul, about, you know, it wasn't really tactics. And like, Liverpool clearly are the more assured team. They look like the more assured team. But actually, something that is so beautiful about football is that actually vibes can sometimes just be the thing.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I agree with that general principle. I think in the game, I didn't feel that way. And I felt it was more about Liverpool's mismanagement. But they were in control. They were 2-1 up. And then what started obviously playing in Klopp's mind was, okay, I've got other competitions coming up. I'm in an absolute fight for the title all the way to the very last against what, not one, but two incredibly accomplished and unshakable teams. And so I've got to start thinking about which of my players are tired and who I'm going to rest. And on the 77th minute, he takes off Szoboszlai, Salah and Robertson, and basically takes off a lot of the leadership in that team. And I actually thought in the second half, United did better defensively. They kind of tucked in a little bit more. There was no more Aaron Wan-Bissaka playing inside forward. And, you know, Liverpool looked a little bit contained, a little bit short of ideas. And then, but they were very much in control of the game. But that, I think those substitutions sent out a signal saying, oh, hang on a minute. If there's ever going to be a chance for United to get back in it, now's the chance, because they've taken off the leaders and they're saying, oh, we can afford to. It was a little bit of an insult. And then, you know, I think it was 10 minutes later, Antony, you know, does the best thing he's done for United and the game turns around. So, again, you know, Liverpool had it back in their favour in extra time as well. Second deflected goal, but still they probably deserved it. But then, you know, Nunes, poor game management, gives the ball away and then suddenly it turns around. So I feel like Liverpool presented United with a couple of opportunities and United seized them.
Hmm. Robin, what did you make of Kobbie Mainoo's performance? I mean, we I don't know how much time we'll have for the England squad, but the big question is sort of holding midfield, right? And he's so good. And it's like,
I'd have,
you know,
him.
He's just so much better than Jordan Henderson. It's just that's all, like, when I'm watching him, that's all I'm thinking.
Yeah, I agree. It's just he doesn't have the experience, I suppose, but he kind of does now, doesn't he? I know he doesn't have an experience with an England shirt. It's just, I find it interesting because I do feel like Gareth Southgate has done this before. Like, when Calvin Phillips was brought in, he played a massive role and he barely had any sort of international experience. He was just superb, wasn't he? I guess the only thing is, I saw some Manchester United fans saying, actually, he's not really a holding midfielder.
Oh, right.
So, because he was kind of going forward and he showed some great skill. So again, is that his kind of future role? But no, what a talent. And he just looks like he unflappable, which is obviously an excellent quality to have.
Yeah, I mean, England notoriously occasionally get flappable.
Sound like us? No.
And I thought Diogo Dalot had another good game and sort of has quietly had a brilliant season in a season where nobody is pointing out good things that Manchester United are doing. And I was really impressed with him.
Also, the galloping Garnacho, is he still going? Just, can you imagine, if I did that... today, I'd be broken. He was in set. But I think that comes back to something that Jordan was saying, that kind of suggests that yes, they do care and they actually are. They're not downing tools. Obviously, it's against Liverpool, so they do have the motivation. So maybe it doesn't have anything to do with Ten Hag. But, you know, we have seen in the past, perhaps they do want to get the manager gone.
And that's why maybe the next game is key for United because, you know, again, people always talk about derbies. It's easy to get up for a game against Liverpool, the rivals, stop them winning of the quadruple. Can they, if that was any other opponent, do United play that well? That again, from an ownership point of view, would be my view if I'm looking to kind of persevere with Ten Hag. Can you get that performance against Burnley away? Do you know what I mean in the cup?
Jurgen Klopp got slightly pissy with a Norwegian interviewer, Paul, who was asking him very reasonable questions, as far as I can tell. I mean, he also might be tired, and it was a tricky time to be interviewed. And Klopp is generally a good human, but he does have form for this.
Absolutely. I mean, I think at the time of the announcement of his resignation, you know, because he made that very powerful interview and showed all his best qualities, and you're kind of overwhelmed with that. And there's just a little voice at the back of my head thinking, yeah, but he can be a real snipey so-and-so in the press conferences. And you know, he is. And I have sympathy. I think if somebody had to be confronted with Ozlot three times a week, every week, you'd probably get a little bit grumpy at some points. And he's not alone either. I think if you move down the league table, you know, Mikel Arteta can do it. Pep can obviously do it. I think I've even seen Ange do it. The question I had is that, has anybody ever seen Emery be pissy with people?
Oh, good question.
I feel like he's somebody who kind of just like always keeps it just about under control. But, I think it's common for these guys are winners, they're battlers, they're fighters, they're going to, you know, they invest so much in it. When there is a kind of sense that maybe they have done something wrong, it doesn't surprise me that they get angry.
I hear this whole argument about winners and that you know, Klopp's a sore loser. So, you know, it's kind of understandable. I'm not sure I ever buy that argument. I just don't think, maybe because I'm a polite person, I just don't think there's any need for being rude. I just think, I mean, my mum raised me with the mantra of you ask a stupid question, you expect a stupid answer. But this wasn't a stupid question. And as I think, sorry, Max, yourself or Paul said, he does have form for this. And I think that this general loving that Klopp's a great guy and he's amazing and I share some of his politics. So I don't want to write him off completely. But this isn't the first time where he's just been I can't use the word I want to use, but he's just been a you-know-what. And I just don't think it's acceptable. And I think, I just think you've lost the game. You're clearly fuming. You were in control. It's a big game. I get it. There's just no need for that. I just don't think he should get off the hook. Or be allowed off the hook for that sort of behaviour.
I mean, I've said it before, but like the whole, I mean, Robin, you have to do this sometimes, right? You can't actually win. Like your questions can't be, it's actually impossible to ask a brilliant question. You're just saying, how was that for you? And if they're in a bad mood, double O, well, what do you think? What a stupid question that is. Like you could, with every question that is asked in the post-match, a manager could turn around and say, well, that's a stupid question. How do you think I'm feeling? We've lost, you know, like, and the interviewer can't really be pushed them like, you know, Jeremy Paxson, because you might have to interview them next week. Or they might say, I don't want to talk to them. And then suddenly, you know, Patrick Davison can't be like, if he pisses off Wenger, you know, not Wenger, it's a bit late for that, but, you know, Arteta and Ten Hag and Pep, then Sky might have to go, oh, that's tricky. We can't use him. I don't know, like, I don't know how you feel, Robin, when you're in that situation.
It's horrible. I really dislike, that's probably the thing I dislike most, because it's especially post-match, because they have to come out, you know, and they're obviously fired up. So I think both can be true. That I think that was probably like his seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth interview, and he's probably a bit, you know, it's just had extra time. His team have lost, and he wants to go home. I get that, but I think Jordan's right. Like, this whole winning thing. You can be a sort of bad loser, but also have a bit of class. And I really dislike it. And yeah, just but for Klopp, I love a lot about him. I love the fact that he said, I'm tired, you know, and said, I'm leaving. I think that really is very powerful. And as Jordan said, he's spoken up on a lot of issues, but he's been exceptionally rude to a lot of people, including my good colleagues. And it just makes me, he gets a black mark for doing that. I just feel like there's no need. There really is no need.
No. Daniel Story, chief football writer for The Independent, tweeted a huge section of the Stretford End singing Always the Victims. And the Sun was right. Chance to Liverpool supporters, grim as ever. Then he tweeted, this morning, arrests have been made, more will, because this is now established as a hate crime. Clubs and governing bodies have condemned, but yesterday felt like hundreds, even thousands. Seems to be getting worse. caused a stain upon a brilliant game. The latest we've got is a Greater Manchester Police confirming that one arrest has been made in connection with tragedy chanting at the game. The FA has condemned the chanting, vowed to liaise with the police over the matter. They say it's entirely unacceptable, can have a lasting and damaging impact on people and communities within our game. It must stop. And we support any club and their fans who try to eradicate this and the terrorists. Manchester United say they're fully supportive of statements issued by the FA and the GMP. And the difficulty, whenever we discuss this, right, is even we, we have a smart audience who care about these things, we'll get a few going, yeah, but you didn't hear it when they did this. You know, that there is still this, you know, and like, we probably don't report on every single bit of hate chanting that goes on in football. It's obviously all grim, and I don't really know what to add apart from that. Apart from I did write a piece about it a couple of years ago, and when I was 16, sung dumb stuff. Never really about tragedy, but about things that I didn't really know about. And I judge 16-year-olds very differently to 40-year-olds, but there is one video doing the round of a Man United fan making some pretty grim Hillsborough-related gestures. I mean, it's really horrible. And you know, you hope he is dealt with and anyone else that does it.
Baffling how it can be growing. I just don't get that. You know, I would have thought there's as much information as there ever has been out there explaining why this is wrong. And I presume these people know that, but still choose to do it.
Yeah. On slightly lighter note, Richard, how many times will you mention Mark Robbins saving Sir Alex Ferguson's job between now and April the 20th when Coventry and Manchester United meet? Yeah, Mark Robbins scored, if you don't know, the only goal in Manchester United's 1-0 win over Nottingham Forest in the third round of the FA Cup in 1990. It was being widely reported ahead of that game that Fergie would be sacked if they lost. They meet each other because Coventry staged an amazing comeback at Molineux after Wolves had staged quite a good comeback themselves to be winning the game going into injury time, and then Coventry scored twice. We established quite recently that nobody cares about Coventry, but we should probably start to care a little bit. Jordan, what an ending to this match.
It was brilliant. I want to just first of all say, you say no one cares about Coventry. I've worked with a producer where I work for 13 years. He's the most miserable person you will ever meet in your entire life. But he was in the edit suite next door to me and we were doing the game. I've never heard him shout and scream and be so happy in the 13 years that I've been working with him. So happy for Jack Taylor. It was a great game. Great game. And they deserved it. I don't think Wolves were poor, but I do think Coventry were the better team. You could argue they should have had a bigger lead at halftime, or they should have been definitely ahead at halftime, because the amount of chance they created in that first half, they were comfortable. They were comfortable. And again, to be down late into the game and then seemingly the game's gone away from them, and then to drag it to extra time and then, nope, we're not done yet. We're going to win this now and go all the way with a really good finish as well. I thought was brilliant. And I think it's, you know, it's always good to have a team that's not one of the big teams or from the Premier League in the last four. So no, it wasn't just a brilliant game. It was a game they deserved to win, I think, over the course of the 90 plus minutes.
And look, I mean, we have talked a bit on the EFL pods, Paul, about how well Mark Robbins has done. And they have, you know, a lot of players who were significant in this game for them. Hadji Wright, Ellis Sims, Callum O'Hare, who came on. You know, these are super talented players.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, this was the classic of the weekend because as Jordan has rightly described, you know, Coventry were excellent. You know, they didn't, they played through them, they played around them, they played over them. They were just the better team. But Wolves found it in themselves to find a solution to that, scored two great goals. And then, you know, Coventry found it again in such a small space of time. I think that is really magic of the cup. And, you know, you're absolutely right. These players you pick out here, I think Callum O'Hare was injured for much of last season in their playoff run. Sims and Hadji Wright are new signings. I think of the, you know, effectively, they lost their two star players over the summer, Gyökeres and Harmer. They've basically rebuilt the entire squad. Like, I think I was comparing a match from last season with Saturday, I think only three players were held over. So, you know, they began the championship season bobbing around the relegation zone, and he's just, you know, rebuilt the team, found that sort of spirit, and they look like they've got, you know, a number of different ways to play. I mean, the job he has done at Coventry over the past 7-8 years is just phenomenal. I don't think there's any comparison kind of in current English football, because he's not done it with money. He's done it with patience. He's done it with player development. He's done it with excellent recruitment. Yeah, Coventry are a shining light, really, because it, again, you know, think about the exile in Northampton and things like that. They've really been on their uppers.
And actually, for people of a certain age, Coventry are a top division team. There'll be lots of younger listeners going, "No, I don't think that is true. I can't remember when they were last in the." In the Premier League.
In the noughties under Strachan, wasn't it? Strachan and Huckabee and Dion Dublin.
The noughties, yes, that's right. Yeah. Oh, that was a good Kobe Jones. Yeah, that was a good fun team. But like a bit more sky blue, you know, a sky blue that are sort of less predictably brilliant in the Premier League wouldn't be a disaster, Robin, would it?
That'd be lovely. Yeah. Very pleased they didn't draw the other Sky Blues because that they kind of have a bit more of a chance actually to get to the final now.
Actually, it's a perfect draw, yeah.
Pretty much. I mean, maybe Chelsea, would you think Chelsea would be slightly? I don't know. maybe one of them. But yeah, just not Man City. But yeah, all great. But we do have to address what Mark Hoffins did, which is just the most pathetic ball boy wronging him. I mean, God, yeah. What would have been like, what, 11, 12 years old? I don't know how old they are. Maybe slightly older, but still celebrating in his face. After the winner, yes. I mean,
well, Alan,
really?
Yeah, it's funny. Alan says, is celebrating in front of a child more or less disrespectful than eating a sandwich in front of a Premier League manager?
We'll have to ask Chris Wilder. So that could be in his next press conference.
So Gary O'Neill, you know, who's got nothing but praise this season. The first time when I saw the Gary O'Neill post-match, I was like, come on, mate. You know, because he made the real point, Gary O'Neill, saying, look, I was really respectful. You know, I waited. They done well. I don't want to sound bitter. And then he sort of went, I thought it was disgusting. The boy is really upset. And I was like, well, that seems a bit over the top. Mark Robbins really did go right. He got to go right in his face. And he is a child. And like Mark Robbins did apologise. He did the right thing saying, you know, I'm apologising to him. He's a young kid. The young kid had earlier dropped the ball and walked away smiling.
He deserves a battering for that.
It really annoyed me. So I celebrate in front of him. I don't show emotion often, but that's what the FA Cup does to you. But I apologise unreservedly for
He's
him.
Blaming the magic of the cup.
I think in a way, everybody's come out okay from this, Jordan. It's not the end of the world. Gary O'Neill sounded a bit bitter, but it was probably right. Mark Robbins was probably wrong, but he has apologised. So hopefully the ball boy is okay, you know?
I think everyone's fine now. Yeah, everything that needs to happen in the end happened in the end. Apologies were given. I think we can move on without
effort. It was the cup, Your Honour.
Yeah. But I also think as well, Mark Robbins doesn't have a sort of aggressive face. So, you know, there are other managers, and I don't instantly want to go to Sean Dyche, but there are other managers that if they did squat and like yell in your face, I mean, I think we talked about Klopp, right? If he did it, I think it'd be quite scary, actually, if you were a small child. Sort of quite demon headmaster vibes from
Moyes.
Klopp. Yeah, Moyes could really sort of, he'd stare through you, wouldn't he? And it'd be quite an angry celebration. Yeah. I think of all the managers, there's a sort of, you know, there's a, I won't say a cuddliness about Mark Robbins.
He's lucky he's got a nice face, is what you're saying.
Yeah, he's got a nice face. So I think, you know, sort of Paddington Bear type face. So I think, you know.
On Wolves though, I mean, yeah, this was quite a big missed opportunity, wasn't it? Because they're going really well in the Premier League. I'd just say the two goals, especially the last two goals, pretty criminal, you know, towards the end of the game, especially like, you know, they get it back to 2-2, you think, okay, we'll do extra time. And then, you know, there's no defending there. So I think, yeah, just for them, it's a missed opportunity, but fantastic commentary and well-deserved.
Yeah, I think you're right. And they've got a lot of injuries, Wolves fans would probably say. Ryan Aitnori does it really, really excellent, but I do not disagree with you. And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Chelsea's win over Leicester. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Chelsea left it late, beating Leicester 4-2 with Chukwuemeka and Madueke scoring in injury time. Producer Joel saying he's not sure he's ever heard so much booing from fans at a game that they ultimately won. And we'll get to the booing, so specifically at Raheem Sterling, actually. I wonder if we should start, Paul, with those goals from and I guess because Chelsea are so random and they've got so many players that you don't spend any time talking about any of their players. So I haven't really spent any time thinking about Chukwuemeka or Madueke, and both their goals were brilliant.
I thought you were going to talk about Axel Disasi, but yes. I mean, the Madueke goal was a combination of sort of real FIFA goal, wasn't it? Like really tight control at the edge of the box, most dangerous place in there to do it, and then a rocket finish into the roof of the net. The pass to Carney from Cole Palmer was excellent. You know, again, some sort of sublime touches from Palmer throughout that game. So, yeah, I mean, Chelsea have the talent. I felt like a bit like watching United on the weekend, you know, like, oh, yeah, no, you guys do have really talented players. You just can't show it on a regular basis. And that, you know, you get that in-game with Chelsea week in, week out. There's bits where they look great and there's bits where they look awful. And clearly the fans are beginning to ask what it's all about.
Weird season, though, Jordan, isn't it? You know, it's their second semi-final in a season where they've been terrible. They haven't lost to Man City yet this season. So, like, they could. I mean, obviously, they're not the favourites for that semi-final. But let's talk about the own goal, because that is why we watch football, right? It's just, I know he gets a bit of a nudge, Disasi. And as Joel says, you know, it is unfortunate to have a name that is so close to disaster. I mean, like, obviously, whenever you make a mistake, that's going to be an issue. But total heaven watching that ball go in, Jordan.
It was beautiful. It was proper. Not even Sunday. That was Saturday League football. That was like on the parks. Just, oh, what's happened there? It was great. And I saw a few people trying to blame the positioning of the goalkeeper. I mean, really? No. That's completely disaster's fault. Disaster's fault even. But when it happened, he struck the ball when I was watching this game again at work. And I just thought to myself, uh-oh, straight away, that's definitely going in. Some back passes that are poor, you can think the keeper can scramble and get there, maybe keep it out and help him out. It was just struck with so much conviction. You just knew the keeper had no chance. No, it was a thing of beauty for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's a question about, you know, the variety of own goals that you can get, Robin, as to what is the, you know, the because that there's a beauty in this one. Everybody knows that it's going in and everyone is powerless to stop it. And there's a long time, you know, between, you know, in relative terms, between the ball being struck and it going in. And I don't know if that is better than just when someone, I mean, my mind, it always goes back to Wayne Hatswell in an FA Cup game who controls the ball and then just twats into the top corner. Like you know, and those two are sort of the two ends of the spectrum. I don't know. Look, we don't need to compare them. Why can't we just love them all? But I don't know where you stand on your favourite type of own goal.
I think you're right. Because like, yeah, as it's happening, the sort of hands go to the heads, don't they? And that's the real beauty of it. But that was like, Leicester weren't in that game at all, were they? No. Until that happened. And then obviously, yeah, and before that, Sterling took the penalty off Cole Palmer, who has scored every single penalty this season. So that was a bit baffling. Sterling didn't have a great day, did he?
No, I mean, he didn't have a good game.
But he set up Cole Palmer, didn't he? But
yes, no, that's true. He did that. It was a lovely break, actually. But I don't watch Chelsea every game, Paul, and every minute of every game. So it feels to me that he's been quite good for them in this weird season. And Barney wrote a really brilliant piece last week about, you know, if this is it for England, actually how good he has been for England. But, you know, he got stick for missing the penalty. He got stick when he took a free kick they wanted Cole Palmer to take. He got stick when Mudryk went off. And then there was this bit when he went off when some people booed and then some people applauded and then some people booed the people booing. And he kind of applauded everyone and seemed to get everyone on side by the end. But I don't know if it felt harsh, because I think he's been quite good for them.
Yeah, I think he's been quite good. I don't think he's not been a leader of that team, though, has he? I mean, I think expectations of Raheem Sterling are high, and there's a number of reasons for that, and some of them are probably not on, to be honest. You know, I think he might be held to standards that other people aren't held to, but at the same time, you know, there's been two seasons at City where he was that he delivered the numbers that kind of people expect him, a guy of his standing, who was a, you know, bought 50 million quid as a teenager to deliver. And I think we haven't seen that since. And I think people are wanting that from him now, and they're not getting that. You know, Cole Palmer is more of an influence on this team than Raheem Sterling is. And, you know, I'm not for booing at any point in football grounds. I don't get why you would boo your own players. I don't think it's productive. I think it makes you look spoiled. I think it creates poisonous atmospheres within the grounds. I don't think it's good. It shouldn't have happened. So, you know, I think the thing about Sterling is that he is always there. He never hides. And I think that is something that is, you know, really valuable and probably underappreciated about him, and something that Chelsea need more of. So, you know, I do think he deserves to be on the pitch for Chelsea. But I think sometimes he's not quite, sorry, that sounds dismissive to say he deserves to be on the pitch. You know, he is an important player for Chelsea. And he delivers something important for them, but he has not always met expectations, I don't think.
I can't think of a player that in the Premier League that kind of has been more conflicted in terms of his talent than Raheem Sterling. Because I thought, if you're an alien and you came down to planet Earth yesterday and watched that game and saw Sterling for the very first time, you'd think this guy is like League One. His technique at times is absolutely shocking. And that game, actually, I've seen that game from Sterling quite a few times throughout his career. But if you look at his career and his CV, there's a couple of seasons where he's got 20 plus goals for City. You know, for England, he was England's best player at the last Euros, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
He's clearly a good player. And I think, to Paul's point as well, he's right. Bar Silva, Sterling's the most senior player in that team. And I just think he hasn't been shocking for that team. He's been one of the few rays of light for that Chelsea team. I don't think he's actually led that team in a way that a player of his seasoning, I think, could have and should have.
So
I thought the whole taking the penalty away from Palmer.
Sorry to interrupt you. It was rude of me. But you're not signing a leader when you sign Raheem Sterling. Right? That's not just because he's old, just because he's older. But he is a player who is a confidence player who delivers at the attacking. But he's not. He might lead by his actions, I guess. But
maybe lead is the wrong word. But when you sign Raheem Sterling from Manchester City for what they signed him from, he's not a kid anymore. I don't maybe expect necessarily leadership, but I expect a guy that can take games by the scruff of the neck more than he has done. I think there needs to be a few more good performances from Sterling than there has been. And I just don't think, look, there's been some poor players at Chelsea since he's been there, but I just think he'll look back on his time at Chelsea when he does leave and think, was that move really the best move to make? And did I really maximise my time at Chelsea? I think you'll probably say no, he hasn't, but that's just my view.
If you were an alien who came down to Earth, odd choice of first thing to do to go to Stamford Bridge on that day. And then, like, you've really assimilated if your first line is, God, his touch is League One. I mean, like, that is amazing that he's like they really, the aliens really, they've really given him a backstory. Like, he really knows his stuff.
Sitting next to. You're sitting next to Adam Sandler as a guest of Todd Sandler, aren't you?
Quite possibly.
They've probably got a data analysis team on the Flying Saucer.
Somebody
goes through the videos, clicks it up.
It always reminded me when, you know, in the lizards, you know, and like, you know, the shape-changing lizards, and like someone was Reagan and someone was Thatcher and someone was Chris Christopherson. And you imagine if you're with that lizard, you'd be like, why have I been given this one? This seems a bit odd. Why am I Bob Hope? Why am I the leader of the free world? Seems like you don't really respect me, my alien abilities. Anyway, to the Etihad, Manchester City beat Newcastle 2-0. I mean, Paul, do we need to say a lot about this football match? It sort of went as we, you know.
I feel like there must be something. I feel like there's a subtext about Newcastle here, but I feel like lots of people know this better than me. I'm looking at Newcastle and going, what's happened to you this season? You know, it's a fail for me. I know there's lots of you can put the case for Newcastle and the injuries and the packed schedule and stuff, but I'm like, you are nowhere near where you were last season, and you spent, you know, nearly 100 million in the summer. So, and I know the reasons why a lot of that talent isn't out there. But yeah, I mean, two deflected Bernardo Silva goals, which are pretty much identical, and the game's over within 20 minutes. I mean, that is City. That's what they do. And but, you know, last season, Newcastle wouldn't let him do it, I don't think.
Mm. Let's go to the Premier League then. In the race for fourth, a bit like last year, I think nobody wanted fourth. And it feels like maybe neither Spurs or Villa want fourth. Obviously, last week after Spurs hammered Villa, we decided that that was it, done and dusted. And, you know, they went on what looked like quite a nice trip to Fulham. And how wrong we were, Robin, because Fulham were brilliant in this game. You know, Matt says, looking forward to Fulham's win being reviewed as how bad Spurs were. Arsenal, United, Spurs all defeated. We've still to play Liverpool at City at the Cottage. We're going to have a big say in the title race. I know Barry has been struggling to work out how good Fulham are, but like on this evidence, really quite good.
Yeah, this is what they can be. They really can be. I did their game last week against Wolves and they basically just missed all their good chances and this was them taking them. So they have no problem creating them. You know, Anthony Robinson rampaging down the left. Fantastic ball in for the first. Muniz, I mean, this is proper ketchup bottle stuff from him, isn't it? Like, just couldn't hit a barn door. Then suddenly it's all come. Yeah. He looks proper player. And they were superb. I mean, I think we do have to say, I think pretty much across the board, you know, Son said it, Ange Postecoglou said it, just the intensity wasn't there. You know, and Fulham had it because, yeah, there wasn't any pressure really on to stop these crosses in and things like that. Did miss a few chances, didn't they, Spurs? But no, absolutely well-deserved win from Fulham. But yeah, very eye-catching scoreline considering what happened last week with Spurs.
Yeah. I mean, every time Spurs lose, Paul, we get a few questions, such as this one from Jelly Belly saying, has Big Ange and Project Highline finally been found out? Spurs were utterly woeful against a well-drilled Fulham who were set up perfectly to hurt that line. Is it time to call out Ange for being completely naive yet? You can't play one way in the Premier League. You get found out.
I think he's not the only manager who plays with a consistently high line, is he? That's Liverpool's mode as well. Huh? And that third goal, I mean, I thought, you know, he got Muniz bundles over Dragosan 2 yards out to poke it in. It's not a high line goal, that one. It's a Spursy goal where the defender didn't want it as much as the striker. Yeah, I mean, I think you know, he is a model. He is a guy who has a philosophy and they're going to play it that way. But I think good teams with good coaches and the right weapons will be able to kind of ask questions of Spurs and damage them in that way. However, I think Postecoglou is a good coach with good players and you can then kind of develop the tactics within a game to compensate for that. So I don't think it's as simple as kind of that tactic, that model has been exposed. He will never win another game. I think sometimes they are going to get beaten by other teams because they're not at that stage of their development yet. I mean, not just in the Postecoglou project, but in the Spursy project, which, as you know, Max, is a lifetime struggle to eradicate this this weakness.
Max, is it the absence of Van de Ven that's a bit concerning? That, like, when he's not there, bit more exposed.
He's such a brilliant
player. He's superb.
I mean, he's not just really fast. Like, he can read the game, but what he can do as a defender is turn his man and bring the ball, carry the ball with his sort of incredible stride. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how long he will be at Tottenham. I think he'll be there a while because I think people like it. But you could see him really going quite a long way in the game, you know, to the absolute peak. I think he's a stunning footballer. So you obviously will miss players like that. Quite interesting. Ange was asked on Friday if Premier League clubs were targeting foreign fans by increasing prices. And Ange said, that's really harsh. I'll tell you why, because I'm probably plastic and a tourist because I was coming from the other side of the world, really passionate about football. And if I could get access to see a Premier League game, that was the world to me. The football club has supporters all over the world, has supporters all over the UK that don't always get access to games, to the games of people who live here. I think it's interesting. My whole view of since moving has changed on tourist fans because, and I think I've said this before, so apologies if I'm repeating myself, but the fans here who support Premier League or EFL sides or whatever, who either go to a pub, you know, they all meet, I don't know, Perth Spurs fans, for example, or whatever, you know, Liverpool fans in Sydney. And whenever the game is, they'll go to the same pub at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., you know, like football in the UK, if you are a fan of a club in the UK, it's just served to you on a plate, right? You might not be able to go to the games, understand that season tickets are hard to get, etc. But like, if you make a lifelong commitment to do anything at 2 a.m, well, like, fair play to you. You are a fan. You are genuinely a fan. So then if you use the money that you earn to fly across the world to go and see a football match, to go to the effort to get that ticket, then it shouldn't be dismissed, right? There are obviously ticket prices are a huge issue, and, you know, who deserves to go to a game is tough, you know, but you can't just say you don't like football because you didn't grow up next to Goodison Park or next to the Abbey Stadium or next to White Hart Lane or whatever. Paul and Jordan wants to come in. Paul?
I think shouldn't Spurs then be subsidising the ticket prices for those fans who are coming from all over the world and are spending a load of money to get there in the first place?
I don't think they should be raising their prices, right? I mean, that's a separate... I think they're two separate conversations. I mean, prices are too expensive for football fans in a lot of stadiums.
I don't think there's any... I think if that's... Sorry, that was my understanding of what you're saying. Postecoglou was sort of explaining it that way. But, like, you know, I think that the idea that prices should be going up anywhere for anybody in the Premier League ground is just wrong. I think it's chiseling the fans and I don't think it's right.
I think what Postecoglou said was correct, and he was roundly applauded for what he said. And I think the term plastic fans is offensive anyway. But I think two things can be true, because I heard someone made an interesting point on Twitter that whilst fans that aren't from England should be respected because they love their club just as much as anybody, and to your point, Max, arguably more if they're getting up at 4 a.m. to watch Burnley versus Luton, whatever the fixture may be. The reason why the Premier League is so popular and the brand is so big is because the fans that, albeit can, but do go every single week. So I don't think we should disrespect the supporters that are not in England. But equally, I think we should remember that the brand of the Premier League is what it is because for 30 years, your hardcore fans travel home and away. Now they can, you in Australia can't, Max. So there's obviously that's quite obvious. But I didn't like the kind of... The forgetting that, again, the brand is strong because Premier League games are packed and have been packed every single week for 30 years. And those people that go every week because they can, but they do.
Sure. And, you know, you should support your local team as well. It's something that I believe. So I don't know how that marries up. But I think, you know, these two, you know, I think you can support a local team and your big team and win things. Don't get me down that route, of course. So Villa could capitalise, and they didn't really, did they, Robin? Drawing 1-1 at West Ham. Some really good VAR. I think it got them right, did it? The VAR, I don't know. I think it probably did, but it just took so long. And it almost feels harsher because it's so late, especially the 96th minute one.
I think they did in the end, because on Match of the Day, I just saw Mikel Antonio was saying that Bowen got the last touch on what was the potential winner.
The handball isn't a handball, yeah.
Yeah, but actually even then they were saying he did kind of move his hand towards the ball. So, I mean, God, it is tedious, isn't it? I'm boring myself with this, but probably a fair result. As I mentioned before, you know, Villa in particular had a really energy sapping. They were fantastic against Ajax on Thursday night. I think Diaby, who was brilliant in that game, made a big impact coming off the bench against West Ham. And yeah, I mean, maybe a bit of a missed opportunity for Villa, but, you know, they've got a Conference League to win, haven't they?
Yeah, and actually they've got quite a tricky draw in that. Lille is actually the one team that I think they probably wanted to avoid.
Well, and West Ham.
And West Ham have Bayer Leverkusen, right? Which is brilliant because... I don't know why I think West Ham can beat Bayer Leverkusen, but I think they can. And I don't think that's just from a sort of Premier League hubris way. Leverkusen are a brilliant team and are playing brilliantly. So West Ham occasionally beat really good teams, Paul. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, no, I sort of felt that as well. That there's just the sort of... I think with David Moyes, sometimes he doesn't mind putting a little bit of grit in the food. Do you know what I mean? There'll be something in there that just kind of... not going to work out, play you, but we'll make it very difficult for you to play your way as well. And he's not afraid of that. And, you know, sometimes that's to his detriment in terms of his reputation, but it quite often gets results on the football field. So, yeah, I think Xabi Alonso's sainted run is likely to continue for a bit longer. So I think they'll win, but I could see that too, possibility. I think West Ham have really come on this season. They're not, you know, they're a bit like Spurs. There's going to be moments where they're going to be inconsistent. But I think, you know, you look at that front four that they're playing, they're putting out there, that's a good front four.
Yeah. And that Kudus goal, he scored two, I think, didn't he? But the one where he just ran past everyone. It was once you said a FIFA goal, it's like a striker on the Amiga goal. It was an amazing goal and just, yeah, effortless. It all looked effortless. It looked
a la George Weir.
Yeah. It was kind of Weir-like. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say this sounds ridiculous. It was almost more like graceful than the one George Weir goal I am thinking of. But obviously there were quite a few George Weir goals, weren't they?
There were.
Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin at Kenilworth Road. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Luton 1, Forest 1. Pretty tense down there at the bottom of the Premier League. Forest 25 points from 29. Luton 22 from 29. Great for Luke Berry. I mean, I watched this guy as a kid at Cambridge. To see him scoring the Premier League is great. You feel that real pride as a lower league fan to see, you know, your players go on and just his joy, because he's got almost no football here. He's one of those few players that scored for Luton in League Two, League One, the Championship and the Premier League. And Robin, they needed that. They massively needed that goal, didn't they?
Oh, hugely. Especially after what happened in midweek, giving away a 3-goal lead to come away with nothing against Bournemouth. I think that could be massive. I think if they had come away with nothing, that would have been huge psychologically. I mean, they're still in sort of danger of letting this season peter out a bit. You know, they're obviously, you know, there's plenty of fight, but are we seeing a bit more? Yeah, it's going to be interesting, obviously. And, well, it might be very interesting. I think it's today or tomorrow we might see if Forest get points deduction. So that could make things interesting. But I did see some Forest fans saying, why did we sack Steve Cooper if this is what's happening now? Because Nuno, I mean, has he had a big impact? I'm not sure. I did his first game in charge.
He started okay.
I did his first game and they were very unlucky to lose against Bournemouth. Do you remember it was Willie Bolly got sent off for that ridiculous...
Sent off for a tackle.
For a really
good tackle, yeah.
And obviously they beat Newcastle really well, didn't they? Chris Wood scored a hat-trick. But then I feel like, yeah, since then I just... You know, Steve Cooper was the saint and, it, you know... Nuno is going to have to do something a bit more, I think, to kind of banish his memory. And I think they're just feeling like, well, what was all the upheaval about?
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of feel, Jordan, with Luton that I feel so exhausted watching them because they're in so many games.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like they've just lost a lot of games really easily and then turned up occasionally. They seem to turn up all the time and then just narrowly miss out. You know, the Bournemouth game is a case in point, but all those home games against the top sides. And I don't know that sort of. I don't know that in that way. That should give them hope, right? That they're very rarely getting done. But I just in my mind, it just makes me feel tired for them
a little bit. And you think that they have put in so much effort and so much commitment to so many games, and to get so little from them. Yes, on one side you think, well, okay, we know we can go close with all these teams, but on the other side you think to yourself, it can be demoralizing to know that we're giving everything, we're getting so close, but yet we constantly come up with nothing to little. So how long that can last for, I don't know. The fact they're scoring goals, I think, is a good sign. I think down at the bottom, scoring goals is really, really important, obviously, to stop letting them in as well. But I think if you've got goals in your team, I think down there, you've always got a chance. I think that should give them hope. I'm still quite positive about them staying up, but yeah, they need to at some point turn this commitment and this effort into points.
Yeah, they've scored 42, Forest have scored 35, Everton and Burnley 29 and Sheffield United 24. Burnley beat Brentford, who aren't totally out of this, Paul, are they, Brentford?
No, they're not.
And you know, okay, this game was decided pretty early on for a red card. I mean, I think it was, wasn't it? It just felt like a weird one to me, but...
In what way?
I don't know. I just wasn't ready for it. I felt like I wasn't ready.
I don't think Reggie on was either.
Yeah, no, anyway. I think it was a penalty. I think it was a red card. But I just didn't feel ready. I was ready for that decision. I was just surprised. I shouldn't be surprised. It was the right application of the law, but I wasn't ready for it. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the sort of the idea that the referee will let things roll a little bit in the earlier parts of the game. Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's, there's something about Brentford. I think Brentford might just squeak, particularly because I think the big factor we're talking about, which Robin's already mentioned, I think is the points, the potential points deductions for Forest and Everton again. You know, that would, I think that could be a very significant factor going forward. And that might leave Brentford enough. But the times I've watched them this season, I feel like they're a little bit stale. And, you know, this is the third season. It's that, you know, it's the new second season syndrome, you know, because you can guard against second season syndrome by reinforcing doubling down. But the mental and physical toll on a small squad that relies on key players, I think, is ongoing and debilitating. And I feel that that's where Brentford are at. And I don't think, Tony scored some goals since coming back, but I don't think everybody knowing that Ivan Tony wants out at some point that suits everybody has been a great help either.
Burnley still have to pay Sheffield United, Everton and Bournemouth, Robin. Mm. Just imagine if they won all of those.
That would be absolutely incredible. I don't think it's going to happen. But no, I mean, they've given themselves a little bit of hope. Fofana has looked like a good signing. He was kind of at the centre of everything. Nearly did a Dion Dublin on Shea Given.
He did miss a sitter. Oh, yes,
nearly
he did.
Yeah, missed a sitter. Then scored a really good goal. Also, he dropped the goalkeeper, James Trafford. That was quite a big call. Some people saying that it came a bit late. So Muric had a good game. So no, so they're 4 points. Yeah, 4 points off, I think, is it? They're 4 points. So
they're 5 points behind Luton and 8 points behind Forest. So eight.
They might be, round their radios or, on their phones.
Maybe you know how big the points deduction is, Robin, and you just let it slip.
I've no
That's
idea.
That's possible, isn't it? Anyway, the Champions League draw. Quite lopsided quarterfinals. Again, like last year, sort of a strong side and a weak side. Anyone know why is there a reason why they do all of these now, sort of for organisational purposes, rather than do the quarterfinals and then draw the semi-finals when the quarterfinals are done? I mean, it is still a brilliant draw, Jordan. I don't know how you're feeling about... Oh, yes, Paul, you have an answer for me?
Well, I sat through a two-hour-long presentation from UEFA last week about the new Champions League.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which is that it was really interesting that Seferin wasn't there, but a lot of the other senior UEFA bods were there, and they were really, really amped about getting involved in a kind of new seedings, new ways of deciding tied league table positions, all this exciting stuff. And it's just like my brain was fried. It was just far too many little rules and regulations. But they want to make it fully seeded from next year. So more like a tennis open. And so I kind of feel like there's something of that in the draws currently, that they want to kind of give people a route to the end so they can kind of plan it and kind of think about
it. I suppose we have it at the World Cup, and I'm perfectly happy with it at the World Cup. In fact, I thrive on it at the Euros and the World Cup, going, have we got an easy draw? Do we need to draw with Serbia? You know, all this ridiculous, stupidity. How do you feel about Arsenal-Bayern? Harry Kane coming back, Jordan, to score at the Emirates?
Honestly, people will think I'm talking absolute bollocks, but I'm like, bring it on. I wanted to draw City because I just think if Arsenal are in this new iteration of Arsenal, are going to be this top club, this big European team, they're going to do things. We're out of the mud, 20 years of being a banter club. If we're going to really be doing things of significance, why are we hiding away from the big teams? Let's take them on. If Bayern beat us, Bayern beat us. But do I think we can beat them over two legs? 100%. The Harry Kane factor is obviously very significant in as far as he's a world-class striker. I think the fact that he's ex-Tottenham is just a narrative that podcasts and Sky and TalkSport will drum down our necks for the next 2 weeks, however long it is. It's not really relevant. What's relevant is he's a top, top striker. I'm just like, bring it on.
I think it is a bit relevant, isn't it? I mean, I'm with you that narrative is sometimes overblown, but like, it's quite a big I feel like that's an acceptable narrative to be excited about.
Him being ex-Tottenham is not going to make him play better or worse. He's going to want to win the game because he wants to win a trophy.
He scored a lot of goals against Arsenal, though, isn't he?
That's at Tottenham. That doesn't mean anything in terms of Bayern Munich. So I'm not really too bothered about him being ex-Spurs. I just think it's a game where Arsenal have to be ready for. The only thing I'm concerned about is Arsenal's lack of what I would call European seasoning. We're on great form. I think we've got great players. Mikel Arteta's cooking, but I just think what we don't have is that nous in Europe at the latter stages. I know we've got to the final once before, but if we lose this game, I think we'll lose it on just against a team that knows how to navigate Europe. And I think that you can't buy that. You can't just get that. That takes years of heartbreak and learnings. But I think it's a good tie. It's an exciting tie. This is where we want to be. Bring it on.
Real Madrid City, Robin. Okay. I mean, City obviously demolished Real Madrid last year in that quite amazing half. The year before, obviously, Courtois was amazing and Real somehow got through. Can you make a case for Real Madrid here?
Not really. They've not been very good, have they? And they've kind of scraped through the vibe.
Scraped through Leipzig, yeah. Definitely. I mean, they're doing well in La Liga.
The vibe team. I mean, obviously, they've got Bellingham and Ancelotti's eyebrows, but can they go through on that alone? I
think that's harsh on Vinicius and Rodrigo to place Ancelotti's eyebrows is more important than them. And Camavinga and Tchouaméni. Like, they've got a wonderful team, but no, I think over two, that'd be really interesting. I think that's a fascinating side of the draw. Mm. And then you've got PSG, Barca and Atleti Dortmund. Barca hammered Atleti, actually, the weekend, didn't they, at the Wanda. And I don't think, Paul, I don't think Simeone's lost a home game in the Champions League knockouts as Atleti manager, which is quite extraordinary. But could this is PSG must look at that and say, oh, of all the years we're going to screw it up, this will be a really bad one to screw up.
Yeah, I mean, where do we think PSG are in terms of its institutional kind of knowledge of how to get through in European tournaments? Because, you know, I think what they've done this year was rejuvenate the squad, get rid of the star name, sort of try and actually build a team is good. And that's the right way to go. And I think it ultimately gives them a better chance of winning the Champions League. But whether they're ready for that right now, I don't know. Barcelona, you know, have managed to find the results when they've needed them in the Champions League. And, you know, kind of clinging on to the Real Madrid's coattails in the Liga. And I think it's a tough call. I think, you know, everybody wanted to play Dortmund. And Atletico got the opportunity. And so I think it could be another good run for Simeone this year.
Yeah, possibly. Paul, we're doing an EFL pod tomorrow, but you're allowed a minute on Norwich. Are you you're sort of ticking along all right?
We're doing good. Yeah, we're playing a lot better than we've played for the past 18 months. So, yeah, it's great. And it's another one, just the sort of on a broader thing that means our manager has not been sacked and he's turned the team around. And 6 months ago, the vituperation for our manager was just unrelenting. And I kind of feel like it's a little reminder for everybody that it's not that a manager, if a manager, inverted commas, loses the dressing room or has no plan B, that doesn't necessarily mean they can't win back the dressing room or develop a plan B over time. And I think that's maybe one of the lessons. Although I still kind of think that probably he's maybe not around for the long term, but he's done a very impressive job.
Dan says an improvement for Cambridge as they only lost by four. Yes, a slightly disappointing week. Played 2-1-0, drawn 0, lost 2-4-0 against 10. But yeah, and a 6-pointer away at Reading at the weekend. Sorry, Gary Monk. I don't know what Gary Monk must be thinking. Like, why did I? I wasn't managing anyone. It was not very stressful. And now I've just shipped 10. What's how anyway? It's really bleak. Anyway, we'll do it on the EFL. The Reading is a big story. They might be news of a much needed takeover by the time we record the EFL pod tomorrow. So hopefully we'll bring you that news. Paul says, is Barry lying low until the furore over his £15 million donation to the Tories dies down? He's a tiny bit like Frank Hester, doesn't he? I mean, does he look more like him or Tom Watson? I'm not sure. Of politicians that look like Barry. She has a TV show in it somewhere. Anyway, he's back on Thursday, everybody. Don't worry. And that'll do for today. Thanks, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Robin.
Cheers, Max.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Max Sanders.
This is The Guardian.